so cumbersome, and they just take so long, and they make the system not work, and there's all kinds of reasons. But what we've learned from the history of security certificates, that we lost way more than we gained from doing that, from actually cherry-picking an issue, cherry-picking a set of individuals, and putting it in that context. What has been revealed over time is that in that structure is, again, that tension between intelligence and evidence that might have to go into a courtroom because of who's gathering the information. They're not even crossing over as individuals. Who does intelligence gathering is sitting in a completely different part of our government system and our institution with different levels of protection and accountabilities than who are police officers, who have a different set of obligations statutorily and otherwise. So that creates an interesting problem. So why would I talk about that? Because remember my suggestion about genteel protests. We know historically, and I would argue there's a kind of functional amnesia we have about this relationship between intelligence gathering and criminality. We can go back at different points in time, and the same thing is being repeated. Investigations, 20s and 30s, of our labor movement because we suspected that they might be in league with the communists, and the continual looking out for potential dangers to the state. This is about state inconvenience, not actually danger to the state. We're in a democracy. People might actually have a different view of the policy and the policy direction. That is not a national security issue. In my mind, that's not why you create national security records, because someone has a different viewpoint on economic or social policy than you do. But post 9/11, this has become even more difficult. Many more permissions are available to engage in the surveillance with a lack of accountability of Canadians. What is caught up in the rubric of being dangerous behavior is actually more significant. I went to McGill. I did my undergraduate here. I was here from 76 to 79. I did my BA here. And during that time, I wouldn't say I was intemperate. I'm the same woman now I was then, just as judicious. And the just as judicious Joanne St. Louis at that time thought it was important to do things like block Sherbrooke Street and prevent people from entering the back of Bank of Montreal because McGill had funds invested in South Africa, and that was a big issue for me. Thought it was really important, in fact, to bring in political speakers who were highly contentious so we could expose what was happening in Nicaragua. Was it inconvenient for the administration? Very much so. In fact, interestingly enough at the time, I was the president of the International Students Association. You notice what I just said, born in Montreal. Why was I the president of the International Students Association? And I'll tell you why. I was the president because at that time, we lost 7 of my friends who got deported back to Iran at the time, under the Shah's regime, because their student visas were revoked because their activity and their statements were seen as political. And at the time, I said they can't remove me from the island of Montreal, albeit by that time my family had moved to Pembroke, Ontario. And I said I was willing to speak about anything that was required. I think we live in a time where justice is not about the words on a page. It is about what you do and what you say. And it can be inconvenient. It can be. I am not standing here saying it's okay for criminals to fling objects into store windows and for police cars to be overturned. But I'm going to tell you this. It is a tremendous mistake to focus on those things and not pay attention to the underlying reason people have engaged in the process of protest in the first place. What is the subject? Is the subject legitimate? Is it not legitimate? And the subjects are legitimate. You are placing the property damage over the damage to our social fabric. That is the equation. And we are creating, by the kinds of responses the state does in terms of power, the creation of records that we may or may not know, all of these different things, we are creating a generation of people that we're trying to suggest should be frightened to speak. I don't remember being overly preoccupied about these things. I thought about them. I really did think about them when I was a student. And I've lived a career that's involved doing some of this work. I've engaged in work in South Africa. I've traveled. I've done things where I would say reasonable. Well, my mother's not here. My mother would say, unreasonable risks. I felt they were calculated and reasonable risks at the time. I don't think we can afford to be risk averse. I think that democracy should be messy and not convenient. I think we have to pay attention to both the chromatics of language and the structure of language. When we talk about something like fairness and we pop it into a piece of legislation, doesn't suddenly transform legislation and make it fair any more than it makes legislation patriotic as opposed to criminalizing their own citizens as they've been doing in the United States. It doesn't change what the thing is. We've got to be less susceptible to some of the branding. We live in a world which sometimes the conversation is very shallow. And I say this because I don't expect people to agree with me, but I would like to have more substantive conversations about what my values are and why I feel the way I do and what information am I relying on and what difference of opinion do you have as a policymaker and why do you want to go in that direction? I do not want abbreviated parliamentary discussions. I do not want over-criminalizing, particularly of young people. I don't want it. I don't think it's healthy. I don't think it's helpful. In fact, I think it is not what we stand for. I want to be able to negotiate what it means to be Canadian in 2012. I don't want to be told by someone who's highly intolerant, who wants to use a politics of fear to convince me that there's nothing for me to talk about. And that if I should talk about it, obviously something's debased or distorted about my thinking. I want to say how difficult I find being in 2012 is in some respects. And it's a contradiction. As a black woman, as a black feminist, as someone who's held some of the positions I've held, and the fact that I'm a law professor, it's a position of incredible privilege in the society as a whole, both in terms of economics, income, where I live, power, literacy about the system. And yet we are in a period that I find highly intolerant. We have given ourselves all kinds of permissions around racialized communities now that I think there's been a fundamental erosion around what we who we thought we were. And I never liked the heydays of multiculturalism. I was one of those people that thought it was a soft focus, group hug, a lot of posters, and people felt good about themselves. But we're in something else now. We're in something else now. And why does that matter? Because this politics of fear and sort of an anchoring and preoccupation with ourselves is shaping also the way in which we see ourselves and engage as global citizens. And it's shaping it at two different levels, our lack of understanding of geopolitics and cultural literacy around economics and its impact, who we have here, from our farm workers to our domestic workers, all of these different sort of racialized structures of inequality, we now completely take for granted. We just don't see them. We don't see the relationship between the unrest and our choices over there and our foreign policy choices and what that means. We talk increasingly about what a luxury. In other words, the same conversation we have about Aboriginal people, they don't pay taxes. We do the same thing. We've got this noblesse oblige and we're trying to rescue the third world. And if only they could govern themselves and if only they could find a way to manage themselves properly, it would be so much better. We don't talk about the amount of their money from their corrupt governments we hold in our banks, which indirectly hold up our economic system. We don't talk about that. Okay? We do not speak about the way in which our structures, like the IMF and the World Bank, create the structural inequalities that actually hamper the sovereignty of these very countries. We have a functional amnesia about our interference when they had democratic policies working, but we didn't like the direction of their governments. We had no trouble seeing it as a sandbox we could play in, and then decades later we say, oh my goodness, if only they could be more mature. If only they could really, really grapple with and understand democracy. We're bringing them democracy. We're exporting democracy as a product to them. When we are living in a thin democratic period and we're not willing to accept that people may have a different view. I'm not cynical about doing the work that I do. But I do think we need a heightened vigilance at this point that we're in. I think we have to reconstruct, and I appreciated very much the panel of journalists that we had earlier, because they are in that very difficult job of crafting the face we see and understand about crime. And it is a very difficult thing. In my classes, I'm sure it's not going to surprise you, I'm either a professor that people love, and I mean really love, or it's like, why am I trapped in this room with this crazy black woman? It really does boil down to something like that. Because I ask questions like, what is crime? If I add up what a criminal does and I say, and I compare that to World Con or Enron, and I say, why the one and not the other in a certain way, in a certain conversation, even the way we label them, the language we use to describe them, it's very interesting. The indirect way in which journalists presume and attach attributes. I remember the Washington Sniper. Do any of you remember the early reports? Initially, with the Washington Sniper, when you deconstruct, and there's an area of studies called discourse studies, when you deconstruct the analysis, they were very convinced, because he was so very clever and strategic, that they were dealing with a white person. Because they were dealing with a white person, the entire vocabulary was about intelligence, strategic, maybe he's a former military officer. All of the language was like that. They discovered they have a racialized person, and the very vocabulary switched to he was cunning. Clever, but not brilliant. No longer the language of intellect. These are choices that journalists get to make. And these are choices that subtly reinforce people's understanding of who we are as communities. Not to say that I would like to be defined through a better vocabulary used for black criminals. That is not my point. But my point is that even in the language of reporting, there is accountability. There is sometimes the opportunity to engage and open up a window to injustice. I happen to think one of the key things in criminality often is that people prey on their own communities. They actually prey on the people most immediately next to them. So I actually am not a person who, for whatever you want to call it, soft on crime. When you work on domestic violence issues and those kinds of issues, you're talking about things that are happening within the community and holding people in the community accountable for what they do. But I do think it's important to not have a feeling of complacency or comfort because it's someone other than yourself. I think that in the midst of all these resources being spent and all the back and forth about how much things cost, there are some things that don't cost any money and decisions that we consistently fail to make. If you take a snapshot and you ask, who are our judges? Those of you who are law students, who are your law professors? If you ask a question, who are sitting in the large law firms? Who's governing your profession? You ask those key questions. Who are the senior administrators in the departments of justice provincially and federally? We are still leading this very basic level of we don't even have proportional to population. And I'm not talking about a photo opportunity kind of idea of multiculturalism here. I'm talking about a structural understanding that there is a relationship between lived experience that somehow needs to be brought in there. Not every person who's racialized is going to bring it, but some of them have to bring it. To me, that is a piece of what it means to deal with the justice system. And if you go into it and take an example that I would consider the example in extremis of Aboriginal people's engagement with the criminal justice system, then you see it. And I am leaving aside the issue of overcharging, over-incarceration, all of those pieces. I'm saying fundamentally, if some of those charges go to the constitutional structural relationship that we are criminalizing practices that ought not to be criminalized, then it matters very much who our judges are. It matters very much that we are much more concerned. We have spoken about diversity in terms of gender at the Supreme Court of Canada. We clearly have constitutionally built in representation for the other colonizer, Quebec, and we have yet to have an Aboriginal person sit on that court. That is a problem. So when we talk about defining what a crime is, its interpretation of statutes requires a way of seeing. In the same way we have understood that we have transformed the understanding of justice by women in all of their diversity participating in a number of roles throughout the administration of justice, we have to understand that this is also about transformation. We need racialized people and people with different experiences sitting in these key positions. But I do want to come back to the group that is never, or it's rarely spoken of. I remember remarking on it when I was a bencher. When I went into the first meeting, I remember, and this is no offense to people in the room, I called my mom and I said, I have never been in a room with so much white hair in my life. That was my main observation. I was one of the youngest benchers. In fact, people were trying to figure out if I was the youngest bencher ever, and there was one other person who was like a year younger than me. And I'm 52. And I was transfixed that the people who are most affected by inequalities in the present structure of the legal profession are young people, and they're not benchers. So it's dependent on whether you have a bencher who's going to speak to those issues. And I'll tell you, I did become the chair of the Equity and Aboriginal Issues Committee and did that for 4 years. But that is still that issue of having to speak through, that having to have that sense of gratitude for voice. It's not the same as power. It's not the dignity of choice. It's not the capacity. And if you do it by tokens and you only have one young person, the burden on them, I think, would be the same as the burden I felt as a black woman walking into that space. There is nothing quite like that feeling of being the only one. I've lived a life like that. You know, my law school life, my faculty life as a black woman alone. There are other racialized people. But it's a very difficult thing to bear the burden of trying to be heterogeneous. You want to be your own self with your own values, and at the same time, you're so mindful that everything you say and everything you do is being seen as being writ large. I think it's a burden that persons who are coming from the majority culture don't come with. But they do come with other burdens. If you're a feminist walking into a space where no one else has those values, you know exactly what I mean of trying to speak to those things. I had an interesting conversation the other day with one of my white male colleagues. And it was interesting because he brings a lot of feminist politics to his work. And he was talking about the double tension for him of strategically wanting to give space and then also knowing he has the capacity to speak to and struggling to figure out what it is and how to do that properly and respectfully, knowing that no matter what he does, there's going to be some dissatisfied people. And I had a short answer for him. I said, sometimes I have no choice at all, so I suggest that you just wade on in, and those of us who understand your good intentions will forgive you for any awkwardness, but silence is far more problematic. So I really don't know. I'm mindful of the time. I'm at 12:11, and I hope that we'll have some questions and an exchange. I don't know what you expected from this presentation, but I do think that we have to be braver. We have to be more engaged. And we have to be less embarrassed by the imperfection of others. I mean, one of the things at the law school I sometimes find, I talk to my students about this, where they say, well, those students, what they did was so awkward. I'm really worried about getting articles, and I don't want to really be affiliated with that, you know, awkward, clumsy presentation that I think might have insulted some mysterious members of the law firm that they think by shadow or telepathy knew the conversation took place in the classroom of all places. You know what? You're not in kindergarten. You're going to be lawyers. And I cannot for the life of me understand how people think they're going to advocate for others, perhaps on totally uncomfortable topics, can be so self-censoring when there is such low risk, and think they're suddenly going to go out there and be transformed into Don Quixote's tilting at windmills because once I make partner, I'll be able to do it. No, once you make partner, you're going to be calcified and you'll be like turned to stone and you won't be able to do a blessed thing. You've got to practice now. You've got to speak up now. You've got to not be embarrassed now. In terms of the national security issues, I'll leave you with this choice. It is a very easy seduction for us to say, well, of course I don't want to protect people who are criminals. Of course I'm worried about whether somebody's going to blow up a building or they might be in a building with my child, my relative, my loved one. But if at the end of the day, what we do is give ourselves permission to disrespect other members of the body politic, if we give ourselves permission to allow records, files, and various things to be created inappropriately, and to not trust ourselves, civilian oversight is not a frightening thing, it's an essential thing. Use of access to information is an essential thing. It's about accountability because we give over our power and trust, but we should not do that stupidly. We have to be able to check. I am not willing to take anybody's word. I'll leave it on that note and look forward to your questions.
Thank you. We have time now for questions and discussion. Where do you want to? Or you can stand here. Yeah, sure.
Oh, that light is bright.
Which light?
The one on the projector.
Oh, yeah.
I was sitting right in front of it.
I guess everyone agrees with everything you said.
That's wonderful.
Yes. Do you mind going to the microphone, please? And I'd ask people to identify themselves if you don't mind. Sure.
Thank you. That was so wonderful. I'm so grateful to be here. And I was running late and so much. Anyway, I'm grateful to be here. This is the question that I have for you. Oh, sorry. I'm Rachel Zellers. I'm a lawyer from the United States who hasn't practiced in about 7 years. I've been in Canada raising my children for the last 10 years, and I'm now, I've been in graduate school for a long time, but I'm now a graduate student in education.
Okay.
And running a school, an alternative school. So the question I have for you is, you know, I've been reading a lot of Michelle Alexander's work in the United States recently, following her very closely because I'm so deeply inspired. And, you know, she talks about three things in her book, The New Jim Crow, the problem of prosecutorial discretion, which you mentioned, mm-hmm. and overcharging, of course, mm-hmm. All white juries and how they're constructed in the United States, in two particular cases, Perkett v. Elm and McCleskey, mm-hmm. and also the problem of racial profiling. Mm-hmm. And she talks about those three things in her book as the things that we have to pay the most attention to.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if you can speak about those three things in particular in the context of Canada, which I know little.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll just leave that question for you and be excited to listen. Thank you.
Thank you. That's a tough question. In this sense, that certainly I would say that I wish my colleague David Tanovich was here, because certainly I consider David the leading expert in that area. And also, I'd recommend reading the work of Reem Bhatti as well, who's also at Windsor with David. What racial profiling does is it puts evidence forward as the preoccupation that you ought to have when the administration of justice operates. And it calls into account the results of the system and questions whether those results ought to be comfortable results or whether they are revealing exactly that. That if I'm on a street and I'm looking, for those of you who are not familiar with it, I'm looking at the street, I've got 13 individuals, and if I follow three or four of those individuals often enough with the same profile over and over again, eventually one of them is going to do something wrong, but what happened to the other seven? And if that's based on race, that's highly problematic. What you have now in Canada, we do have racial profiling, and we've had it for a very long time. And part of why I named the issue of vigilance is that I think that sometimes we do live in two different worlds. I remember doing an early judicial training around issues of race, and in front of the judges in the room, I asked the judges how many of them had ever found themselves stopped as a sex trade worker, and how many of them had ever found themselves, in fact, I did have a companion question, of ever having been mistaken for someone who was a pimp. And they looked at me like, if I was crazy, why would I ask this question? That is because since I became a lawyer, it's happened to me on three occasions. When I said that to them, they said, what did you do that caused that to happen to you? I said, well, let me give you the first example. I was exiting the Vancouver courthouse on the first day I went to argue a motion on behalf of my law firm. I was no different from any other article student. You can imagine how I agonized over what I was going to wear on that day so that I would look professional and appropriate. I came out of that courthouse and I was stopped by a police officer who began to ask me a number of questions. This is where it gets amusing, because what happened is my law firm actually represented the police association. So I was trying to figure out if I was supposed to help this man because I could not remember having met him at any meetings. So you've got statements from me like, can I help you, officer? What can I do for you? You've got a range of things coming out of my mouth as he's trying to figure out if I'm going to solicit God knows what. So all of a sudden it comes to me that this is the issue. You ask me why? Because I paid attention to things like that. Things that maybe my other women colleagues never did, I always did. And I looked at him and I said, you think I'm a prostitute, don't you? And he said, are you? And I said, I know there's been an influx of black prostitutes into the city. There had been within the last couple of weeks. And I said, a number of the high-end prostitutes actually are around the Hotel Vancouver. I said, we are several blocks away from the Hotel Vancouver, and this briefcase does not contain whips and chains. You've made a terrible mistake. It's amusing on one hand, but on the other hand, it's that peace. Because why am I describing it? Because if that is what I experience, it tells you something else about their expectations of everybody in the community. I'm in this privileged position, which supposedly should have made me invulnerable, I would argue to that. And I can go on about the number of black lawyers who can talk to you about entering into courtrooms and being mistaken for accused persons and being directed in a different direction. We see that it's not just American, it's Canadian, and it happens. And that's what's so embarrassing about it. And I'm saying if those kinds of things occur, we have something to address. And why is it important? And I agree with her that it's so important, is because even in the context of what I'm talking about, if that is the context of our community and where we live, we shouldn't be surprised when a Somalia issue occurs. These are people that are part of us where we have not excavated our own racial attitudes. We've not worked on those pieces. And so we shouldn't be surprised in a place where they have incredible power, privilege, and autonomy from the local population that one of our people, something might go wrong. Not that the whole military is rotten, that's not my point at all. But we shouldn't be surprised when errors like that of that magnitude occur because permission comes with power, authority, and the barrel of a gun sometimes. And so if they're even further away and displaced, it becomes a question. That's the relationship of accountability. So I would agree with you that it's critically important. I certainly agree with her about all three. I think we have the knowledge. We know what to do. But nothing in the omnibus bill and the recent preoccupation demonstrates that this is actually informing government policy any more than government policy is deciding that they need to deal with representation.
And I'm in communication studies and in education. I'm currently taking a critical race theory class. It's actually a student-initiated seminar because I guess the law school didn't find it useful to actually have it as a concrete course. So students had to initiate the course. And I think that's an important point. But I guess the question I have is this. I really enjoyed your talk. It moved me. As a first-generation Chicana from working-class background, it definitely moved me on many levels. I guess what I just want to say is, as an activist scholar, as a critical race feminist doing this work within the law, I find it extremely tough, I guess, or maybe you can comment on this, about how do we even talk about these issues of race, racism, intersectionality, et cetera, within Canada in particular. I'm from the States originally. But, you know, denial is not a river in Egypt, as we say, and racism does exist here. But, you know, I find it very tough. Excuse me, I'm talking too much. Let me phrase it as a question. I guess more about how, in your own activist work, how do you struggle to talk about these issues within a Canadian context, and I believe also in the U.S., where color blindness is reigning? And I think you've spoken about it at length, but I'd love to hear more. So,
one of the difficulties, I certainly, at school, speaking at U of O, I've developed a number of different ways, both in terms of my pedagogy, but even in my interaction with students, because I want to transfer what I think are skills that I have to students. It goes without saying it's uncomfortable, and it goes without saying you have to be... I would say patient, in the sense that there are things I need to learn. Just because I do teach a course on CRT and I do fold these kinds of things into everything I do, I don't have an expectation that my colleagues have to be perfect on the issues that are most important to me. I try to see beneath the intention that people have when they're speaking to me. I think sometimes we're very impatient, especially at the first conversation, partially because we've lived an experience that we're so frustrated that we're in that first go of a conversation that we're already ramped up and saying, you've got power, you've got authority, do X, Y, Z. And I don't have that as a personal style. I do have a very, very direct style. I believe that it is critically important that people not be permitted to see me as anything but a black woman in the space. I don't let that sliding off happen. It doesn't mean I always speak only from issues that affect the black community. I don't, in fact. I'm right now involved in the Aboriginal child welfare case that's on judicial review. I'm co-counsel for the Assembly of First Nations. And so I do a range of things with other communities. I think what we need to do and what makes it difficult for us as racialized people is how you enter into the conversation, you have to evaluate the space. If it's a one-off, you can be much more direct and you can have almost that scorched earth. You say what you have to say, I'm up here at the podium, I say what I have to say, you chat with me over coffee or you don't. It's fine, you tweet and say, oh, I didn't like what she said or I loved what she said. When I'm in the classroom, it's a different matter entirely because I'm teaching everybody in the classroom, not just the students in the classroom who share my values. And so that creates a different kind of dynamic because I think it's less about me and my personal values than an ability to articulate the reasoning that I use. So I tell my students, I make my head very transparent. I remove privacy for me in that sense as a teacher. When I'm exchanging with colleagues and I'm in the law society, it's very different. When I get up to speak in those environments, I'm conscious of the fact that there can be tremendous resistance, and I do prepare tremendously. I make sure I have every stat, everything that I need. Even though I know that I could just speak off the cuff, I make sure I know every single thing so that I'm not vulnerable where they're saying you're ideological and what's that based on. I always actually present the evidence, sort of similar to the style here, present some of the evidentiary pieces and then go on to the pieces that reflect my values. That's what I would suggest because then you're calmer. You at least know where you're coming from. But you know what? The other thing is just allies. And I found over the course of my career that my allies have not always necessarily, some of the most difficult pieces for me in my work has been work as a black feminist in mainstream feminism. It's been extremely difficult at times to do. I have mentors who are very significant white males to me throughout my whole career. I have people from other communities, and I have younger people who are critical to me. And I say that honestly because I more recently have been getting involved. I paint. I oil paint. And I've actually did a small exhibit called Corrective Lenses because I wanted to figure out whether art could actually redefine the way in which mainstream white males had constructed women of color. That was really very much about working with young people, not looking for peers, but looking for people willing to think in a very radically different way about the nature of theory and practice. So it's always about renewal. It's always about engagement.
Hi.
Hello.
My name is Akil Lawrence, I'm an alumni here at McGill. I really enjoyed your presentation. In fact, I enjoyed the quote-unquote rawness of your speech. My question is simply actually just to refer you back to your original, subject matter. How do you feel that the war on terror, post 9/11 environment, has somewhat shaped the mobilization efforts or has somewhat developed the mobilization efforts from people across different religious backgrounds, different cultural backgrounds, people that feel that they not only have either one strike against them from their religion, two strikes against them, regardless of their gender, religion, or three strikes against them, whether it be their religion, their racial identity, and their gender identity as well. How do you feel as these different factors have somewhat shaped people's movement to, quote-unquote, fight in terms of this post-9/11 environment? Has it opened up a gateway for people to mobilize more, for people to criticize government government doings, quote-unquote hidden conspiracy theories, so on and so forth. How do you feel this environment has shaped that, whether it be in Canada or in the States?
I have two different views. I have a positive and then I have a concern. I do think that we are at this point where a lot of people are thinking about it and concerned about it and working on it. Okay? So I do believe that when certain things happen, so you have an inquiry, for example, like an Arar inquiry, something that catalyzes people's attention, and you can find, not just in an immediate region, in a sort of national or international sense, there's a heightened attention because there's a sense of the outrageous archetypal victim. The mobilization, when you think about, for me, looking at the omnibus bill and what was happening, I thought there was actually very little engagement of seeing what the ramifications were of a whole bunch of those elements in the context of that situation, and yet it was about a legislated regime which will disproportionately affect all of those people, I think, because they bear the same characteristics as people who are already experiencing systemic racism with a heightened issue of potentially being seen as a potential terrorist or having affiliations that are inappropriate. So I think that's one part of it. The part that's a I think that can be worked on, though. I think there's a momentum, and I think there are people that are interested in it, and the more of those kinds of issues that come to the fore, I think we have a conversation going. The conversation that's actually of more concern to me, and it's more subtle, is the conversation that's related to it. So whether I look at, I would take an Ontario example, because you had Bouchard-Taylor, but the Ontario conversation was at another level in certain ways, and I'm more familiar with all the details of it. In that context, what you have is this split that's happening amongst progressives. So this assumption that we're tackling terrorism and we're tackling this culture, so we now move the next step, these cultures are problematic. The main symbol of the culture is the veil. And you suddenly have this notion that I'm manifesting my solidarity with women of color because I am now anti the veil, that secularism is the only way to go. And that is a very, very complicated position to have when you're talking about the Muslim community, which is so, so diverse internationally. There are so many different meanings to the veil. There's so many different contexts. And so when you assume that you already know and you rob those women of agency, we're not talking about the same dynamic as REAL women versus, you know, feminists and that sort of argument, which we've had. We're familiar with that argument. It's not that kind of argument at all. It's a much more sophisticated, complicated argument. It's a complicated discussion because the role of faith in human rights politics coming out, particularly of North America, is that we've always been in a challenge and a tension with faith, right? So the idea is those who espouse faith, and we sort of hold up the sort of draconian right-wing Bushisms and the church. But as a black person, and I mean not just as a Canadian, the relationship between faith and liberation struggle for people of color globally, the nature of, for example, liberation theology is fundamental. The role of the black church as a community organizing fulcrum is essential to the dynamic of communities in Canada and in the United States. So that lack of sophistication of being able to, yes, faith needs to be criticized. Yes, sometimes the church might be used to occlude sexual violence within families, etc. But that does not mean that there is not a key relationship between faith and social justice. And we seem to forget that. We celebrate Martin Luther King's Day and we forget he was a man. He was a spiritual person, fundamentally a spiritual person, not a writ large New Age spiritual person, a man of the church. We forget that. We forget the relationship of the whole anti-slavery movement in the church. And so I think what I'm seeing is a strange partnership between this anti-ideological piece that we're seeing in mainstream religion and that it's meeting, though they can't quite see each other through the opaque glass, but they're very close in proximity to that glass on either side of progressives who are also having problems with faith. And unless we can tackle that piece, we're also disempowering ourselves.
Hello, I'm David Plazek. I'm a political scientist from Linden State College in Vermont. And being as such, I enjoyed your distinction of evidence-based thinking. And what came to mind as you were talking is somebody who has studied right-wing media in the United States. And this is a phenomenon which goes beyond the states, especially with the internet. And based on the notion that information is power, being able to withhold information is power, being able to shape and propagate images is power as well. What role has the media, and in particular right-wing media, had in perpetuating racialization, white privilege, justification of racial profiling? I mean, I can turn on certain outlets in the States, and within an hour or two, I'm going to hear certain perspectives about Muslims, which aren't reality-based. They're more ideology-based. So what impact does that have on these outcomes?
I think that's such an excellent question. It's one of the things that I've been struck by, that as much as I've been fascinated, for example, by the new media and the ability to democratize access to information and conversations. So we use the term indie media, and we almost, you know, I'm often in settings where people use indie media and they almost use it as to juxtapose against something we see as mainstream media, and it almost has this aspect of being an uncritical good. When in reality, indie media is the whole spectrum of ideology and political perspectives. It lends itself to a different kind of understanding of what speech is and what accountability for speech is. The piece that I think is really a difficult one, and we have some hope in Canada, our actual construction of speech is different from the States. There's always been the sense in the States that speech as a right is such an uncritical good, or you have to tolerate a high level of speech that could be racist and problematic. In Canada, we've tended to regulate it more. The thing with the new media is that that commons of the new media is actually, and I find it interesting where people talk about it as a commons, it's really corporate space. Our whole internet is actually corporate space. It's Facebook, it's a corporation, Google, and all of these different tools that we're using, the space is not actually like walking down the street. And in fact, walking down the street, increasingly we have less and less of a commons. People walk around in the mall and the sidewalks on the mall. We're in a lot of space that's no longer truly public. And in that context, I think you're very right that the ability to form niche audiences, the ability to form alliances across a broad geographic base, which would have been much more difficult, and the immediate impediment of the structure of creating a bricks and mortar site to be able to run traditional media is increasingly being lost. And so those filters mean that there's a complete lack of quality control. I think it is highly, highly problematic, but in the American context, it's almost impossible to silence because the other norms that exist in that political culture around speech and the legal norms actually make it very difficult to regulate. In Canada, we're going to be able and going to have some choices to make as cases go up in the court, but it'll be interesting to see where they go. But we at least have the possibility of regulation, which I think would attach here to the shock jocks and others that are increasingly seeing themselves as emulating Americans. But the interesting thing will be the extent to which we can actually do anything about rabid new media. So the ruling may not be able to have an impact just simply because of how difficult it is to regulate the internet generally once something is there.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Colleen Morowitz. I'm an undergraduate student in the Faculty of Arts. Thanks so much for a great discussion. I was very interested in what you were saying about the discomfort and fear of young people referring to your students in dissent and in sort of speaking against the mainstream. And so just to take this to a context I'm very familiar with, I've been very concerned with some of the rhetorical framing that students at McGill have used against other students who choose to dissent and choose to speak out against certain circumstances they're not comfortable with. For instance, a phrase that has been going around among students to describe other students is that there's a radical minority. And I mean, on a very fundamental level, that really concerns me because I think it's problematic in that it's not the actual structures which these students are opposing who are saying you're a radical minority. It's in fact other students and other people in the same position who are marginalizing through these framing devices and saying you're radical, therefore you have nothing important to say, you can't be rational, you're going against the mainstream. And that really concerns me because a university, I feel, is a place where to be radical shouldn't be a dirty word. To be radical is to question what's around you and really to have a place to make your views known. So my question to you is, do you think that this sort of marginalization through rhetorical framing is something that's getting worse or better, especially in a university context? That's what I'm most familiar with. And I'm very concerned that it is really stifling to debate and to dissent.
I don't know if it's getting worse. I think every sort of historical moment has that context. As much as we were agitating and advocating when I was in school in the 70s, we had colleagues who were like, have you lost your mind? This is not appropriate. There was the issue of, what do you mean as a group of black people? You're not necessarily speaking for every black person. So the issues of voice, authenticity, or authority to speak come up in a range of different ways. I think the minute the individuals start directly engaging authority figures, that's when there starts to be the shearing off. I do think there is a shallowness to it in terms of the rhetorical arguments. I don't know if it's worse, but we live in a culture where I tend to think it's more pervasive as a technique. We live in a culture where the cult of celebrity dominates. We don't know these people, and we believe we're entitled to huge amounts of access to their intimate lives. They're making a film. You don't know them. Why should you know about their marriages, their children, their thoughts last night? So we sort of have a condition that seems to set up a shallow kind of engagement or intimacy and a lack of professionalism. It's almost like we're not modeling how to engage in political discourse. And I think that's what I think is the challenge. How do you have disagreement that's substantive? So when you said a radical minority, the first thing that popped into my mind was Angela Davis, because the meaning of the term radical is getting to the root of things. So I actually would suggest that possibly the person engaging in talking about radical minorities is anti-intellectual and perhaps needs to look a little bit more at their political history. But that's just how I tend to argue. But you see my point. I think part of it is just not owning the language. Don't let the person frame the setup. So they've set it up. I don't have to reply to the same content they've just offered. I simply don't have to give them permission to define me into their argument. But we need to do more of that setting up of environments where we engage in those kind of structured, detailed conversations, everything from using documentary films and then having a debate among students to do that, to, you know, figuring out how do we actually have really hard conversations. But I think I do see it. I don't have empirical data, that's why I'm reluctant to say I think it's worse, but I'm very concerned with what I do see.
Well, we could carry on this exciting conversation forever, but we do have lunch coming. So I'm going to ask Michael O'Shea, who is a very talented and impressive Fulbright scholar who's visiting the Institute this year, to officially thank our speaker.
All right, thank you, Will, for thanking me before I thank Professor St. Louis. On behalf of MISC and everybody here, I just wanted to formally thank you for that very spirited and powerful, I would say, timely speech, too. I think she got at the root of what the threats are to our democracy and how we can make our society more fair and more inclusive. So, as a small token of our gratitude, I present this box to you. You probably don't know what it is, so it's a surprise. So, please join me one more time in thanking Professor St. Louis.
Lunch is next door. The next session begins at 2 p.m. sharp.